Thanks so much for your welcome this morning. It's great to be back. It's been a while, but it's always good to be back and fellowshipping with you. And thanks, Linda, for letting us in story this morning. Story is so important, isn't it, for us as individuals? But I was thinking just recently, actually, that, you know, story is very powerful. We all have our own stories, a mix of good and bad and indifferent. But when there's a shared story, it becomes enormously powerful, you know, when a community shares a story. And so much of the Bible is actually about the shared story of a community. So we enter into the story of others and we share it with them. Just before I talk about the passage this morning, for those of you who don't know me, my normal day job, if you like, is on faculty at Moreland College, which was Vos Seminary until a couple of years ago. And we've just had our start to the year, so we're in about week four of the semester. It's been a very encouraging start, a lot of people coming to train for ministry and mission and also to be more effective as people of faith in their workplace as well. So not everyone comes to train for a ministry particularly. We also started chaplaincy and education programs this year, which is really exciting. So we've got about another 20 students who are studying in those areas. Again, they want to be more effective as Christian people in the counselling realm, chaplaincy realm, and also in education as teachers. So some very encouraging things happening. If you want to talk to me about study at Morling, happy to have a chat afterwards, although I recognise that time's a bit pressured this morning because of the AGM. But, you know, we love having people come and study with us. Some people study formally, some people just audit, so they come and sit in the classes and all of those things are available, and some people here, as I look out, have studied with us over the years as well. So it's great to share with you, and what an interesting passage, the beginning to Matthew's Gospel. When I was asked to speak, my understanding was that you were looking at Matthew's Gospel. I don't know if anyone else has talked about Matthew's Gospel to this point. So if I repeat some things, that's probably good because we always need to hear things, you know, a couple of times, or at least I do. But if I offer something new, then hopefully that'll be thought-provoking for you as you think about this passage and Matthew's Gospel more generally. What I want to do this morning is really three things. I want to open up some thinking about why this gospel might have been written in the first place. I think that's a really interesting question. I want to encourage you to think about why does the gospel start in this rather strange way? And finally, and this may sound really odd, but I want you to think about Matthew chapter 1, these first opening verses, and what they might say to us today. It's kind of a so what question. We read these genealogies, and what do they mean to us? What significance might they hold for us? So I want to begin by making a few comments on the context of Matthew's Gospel. You know, all books emerge from a context. If you take the Bible as a whole, the Bible itself emerged from a context. Every book in the Bible emerged from a context. Anything you read today, a movie that you watch, a piece of art that you look at, an opera that you go to, they all arose out of a particular context, and it's often difficult to know what that context was, to know, in this case, what the writer of a book was thinking and experiencing when they produced the literature that we have. But I think it's important to think about some of those issues, and with Matthew's Gospel, we can actually know some of the context in which Matthew was writing. But before I go there, I want to start with us and how we see the Gospel of Matthew. It's the first one in the New Testament. So, you know, if you were fresh to the Bible, you'd never read it before, and let's say you had a Gideon's Bible. You're in a hotel room staying overnight and you open the drawer and there's a Gideon's Bible, and it might just be a New Testament. So as you would with most books, I guess, you open to the first page and what do you encounter? A genealogy, the one that we've just had read to us. But you don't get it read to you in three sections. You just have to read the whole thing. A very interesting start. But it's the first gospel, so it's had a prominence simply because people encounter that when they first start reading the New Testament. It's also very famous for some very famous passages. The Beatitudes, for example, the Lord's Prayer, the Great Commission at the end of the book. There are lots of passages in Matthew's Gospel. They're present in other Gospels as well, but it seems that the ones we remember seem to come from Matthew's gospel. Seek first the kingdom of God, a very well-known verse for many Christians, again, comes from the gospel of Matthew. It's been the focus of so much teaching and preaching in the last 2,000 years of the church. If you think of the Christmas celebration, the two stories that are focused on are Matthew's account and Luke's account. We don't think about the Christmas story in relation to Mark's gospel or John's gospel. We probably should, but they start in quite a different way. It's interesting as well that if you go back in history, Matthew's gospel is the one that is most cited in the early church fathers. So for the first few hundred years of the church, when they were thinking about who Jesus was and what Jesus meant to the world, they would typically go to Matthew's gospel. So given all of that, it's probably pretty important that we understand what's going on here and why Matthew wrote the gospel. And for us this morning, why he began his story of Jesus in the way that he does. Now, I've used the word gospel a few times already. And it's interesting because, if you went outside to some of the people who are out there in the park this morning and said to them, what do you think gospel means? They might say it's a type of music. If you're using it in everyday language, probably the only way we use it today is when someone says to you, it's gospel truth, which is really strange because that has very little to do with the actual word gospel as we find it in the Bible. The Greek word from which we get gospel is actually more simply translated as good news. Many of you know that. Or even better still, it's actually something like good newsing. I know we wouldn't say that in English, but it's actually a verb. It's something you do, it's not something that simply is. The good news of Jesus is an active thing, like the Spirit is an action of God. Matthew doesn't talk about the good news until we get to chapter 4. So it's kind of implicit in the opening to the gospel. If you go to Mark's gospel, he's right up front. He says, this is the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ. So he announces it right from the very beginning. But there's one thing for sure, and that is that the good news that Matthew is writing about is good news, or was good news, for the people of Matthew's day. Not just for the Jewish people, but for all humanity. But it seems that Matthew was writing especially to his people. Matthew was a Jew. He was a tax collector. One of my colleagues at Voice is just at Voice. That's my memory from the past. One of my colleagues at Morling has just published a book, Matthew the Tax Collector, and it's the story of how Matthew went from being a tax collector, an outcast in society, someone that everybody hated, a bit like the tax department today, I guess, but the tax collector in his day was not a well-liked character, but he went from a tax collector to a disciple, a follower of Jesus, and an apostle. We need to recognise too that this is not really Matthew's gospel. You know, sometimes we refer to Matthew's gospel, Mark's gospel, Luke's gospel, but it's actually the gospel according to Matthew. It's the good news according to Matthew. And that's an important thing to consider. When Matthew wrote his good news about Jesus, his story about Jesus, we know that the gospel of Mark, the good news according to Mark, already existed. It was an earlier production. Probably around the time Matthew was writing, Luke was probably writing his gospel, and then John came a little later. So even the people of Matthew's day knew that this wasn't the only story of Jesus. And you may have wondered why there's four stories of Jesus. There are actually more. We have four in our Bibles. But, you know, that's a question to explore for another time. Here's another interesting thing. We know that Matthew was writing from a place called Antioch, which is in modern-day Syria. So in modern terms, that's not too far away from Jerusalem, but in the ancient world, it was a long way away. So he's writing to Jewish believers in a place that is far distant from Jerusalem, where the events, many of the events in Jesus' life, occurred. The other interesting thing is that he seems to be writing to Jewish people. And one of the reasons we know that is because as you read through the gospel, he often refers to Jewish customs and laws, but he doesn't explain them. He seems to assume that the people who are reading his story actually understand what they're about. And that should put up a flag for us because, you know, most of us probably don't understand Jewish customs and laws. But Matthew doesn't explain them, he just uses them in his story. It's also interestingly possible that Matthew was writing for his church fellowship. And the reason that we say that is because he's the only gospel writer who uses the Greek word for church. You don't get the word church until you actually get to the book of Acts, quite a bit later in time. So initially it seems that Matthew was writing the story of Jesus for a group of people who were Jewish, but they were a long, long way away from Jerusalem and the events surrounding Jesus' birth, life, death, and resurrection. We also know it's a Jewish gospel because Matthew focuses a lot on Moses and David. Now, there's no mention of Moses in the genealogy, the section we looked at this morning, but as you go through the gospel, there's lots of clues that Matthew is actually talking about Moses. And, of course, we had King David in the genealogy. We'll say a bit more about that as we go through. So, in light of that, what else can we say about genealogies? Well, whatever else we might say, Matthew's gospel has a very strange beginning. For us as modern readers, we don't expect to pick up a book of any kind and read it and start with a genealogy. It's very, very strange. And as I suggested, if you were doing that, you would quite possibly give up before you got beyond the genealogy. A number of years ago, Josh Lee wrote a book entitled Hold an Audience Without a Rope. I don't think that's the way you hold an audience without a rope, by starting with a genealogy. And as I said before, each of the Gospels start in their own unique way. Luke has a genealogy, but he doesn't put that in until chapter 3. He starts with what we might call an ordinary kind of story. Well, that led one commentator to say that when you encountered Matthew's Gospel, it's distancing and forbidding for many modern readers. I'd go further than that and say it's probably going to encourage you to give up straight away before you even get started. But here's an interesting thing. We know, because we have the writings still, that genealogies were very common in Jewish, Greek, and Roman writing. So for people in the ancient world, it may not have been so strange to actually begin a story with a genealogy. And if you ask the question, why would you put a genealogy anywhere, certainly at the beginning, well, there seem to be two reasons. One was because you wanted to glorify the significance of the person whose genealogy it belonged to. And the second was that you wanted to affirm that their story connected with some story that came before it. And I think both of those are really significant when we come to this genealogy in Matthew 1. Now, of course, there's lots of genealogies in the Old Testament. And that's my area of teaching. And I really enjoy when we come to genealogies because I ask students, well, what are they there for? I have a friend who did a doctorate in genealogies. He was focusing on First Chronicles, which is actually a really long genealogy. It goes on for about 11 chapters. And if you asked him, why are genealogies present, he would say, read my thesis. But actually, if you pushed him a bit further than that, he would actually say the reason that genealogies are present in the Bible is to connect the old with the new, to connect one story with another story. Now, I don't know if you've ever done this. It's pretty common today, I think, for people to trace their family tree as far back as they can. And I've got a few friends who've gone back centuries, a long, long way, if that's possible. In my family, on my mother's side, we actually go back to the second ship to come to the Swan River Colony. That's kind of as far back as I think we've been able to go, so the early 1800s. But it's interesting because I think part of that is our desire to connect with our past and have a sense of where we've come from. It was interesting, Lyndon, this morning when you were talking about the 25 years of this fellowship and then, of course, the history before that as well. That's all part of the story. Even for those of us who might be newer to this fellowship, that's still very much a part of the story of this group. So connecting stories is really important. And one commentator actually picks up on that, makes the comment, its opening genealogy here in Matthew provides a smooth transition between the scriptures of Israel and the story of Jesus. I'm not sure about the smooth transition bit, but it certainly gives a connection between the two. Jesus' story was seen by Matthew as being a significant connection with the story of ancient Israel. And it's interesting that Matthew doesn't see the story of Jesus as displacing the story of Israel. You know, he doesn't suggest that, oh, we just put that story to one side because we've got a new story now. But nor does he say, well, we just need to focus on the old story. There's actually something new. There's a new story that has come along, and it's very, very significant. So that smooth transition, that connectedness, is really important. I want to suggest to you this morning that understanding the story of Israel helps us to understand the story of Jesus. But it works the other way around as well. Understanding the story of Jesus helps us to understand the story of the people of Israel in the Old Testament. One writer said that the purpose of a genealogy in the Bible is not to give an accurate history, but to set the story of Jesus in the ongoing story of God's acts throughout history. And again, Lyndon, you highlighted that beautifully, that what happens in this place this morning is not an isolated event. This is very much a part of the ongoing story of what God is doing in the world. And that's true of any church fellowship anywhere in the world. It's true of any place, which is actually every place, where God's Spirit is present and at work. So let's have a look at the narrative itself. Let's have a look at the genealogy itself. Well, the first thing that's really interesting to notice is the way that it's written. And if you have a look at it there, I'll just read the opening section again. An account of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God, the son of Abraham. And then it says, Abraham was the father of Isaac. And unfortunately, our English translations fall down there. Because this idea of Abraham was, Isaac was, Jacob was, doesn't capture the sense of story. For those of you who grew up with or are familiar with the King James Version, I know it's old language, but it does actually capture the sense of story. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob, and so on and so forth. This idea of bringing forth children, we've talked about that this morning as well, bringing forth children, bringing forth new generations of the story. The first verse is packed with a lot of goodies. It begins in the Greek with Biblos Genesios, which echoes Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created. It also echoes the beginning of Adam's genealogy way back in Genesis chapter 5. Now, you might say to me, well, that's a long stretch. Well, I can tell you now that an ancient Jewish audience were very astute at picking up on these echoes. And those sorts of things are the things that they would have noticed. They would have listened to the opening words of Matthew's gospel. Of course, they wouldn't have read them themselves. They would have had those words read to them. And they would have heard echoes that what God was doing in Jesus was something like what God was doing at the beginning of creation. That's pretty awesome, isn't it? This is like a new creation story, except this creation story is focused on Jesus the Messiah, which leads us to the next point. Jesus is called a Messiah. There are only three figures before that that were called Messiahs in the Bible. The first one was Saul, the second one was David, and the third one, perhaps surprisingly, was Cyrus, who was a Persian king. But they didn't have the title Messiah. The word Messiah means an anointed one. They were kings who'd been set aside as anointed leaders. But here in Matthew's gospel, Jesus is not just set aside as a leader. Jesus is the Messiah. He is the one who has been anointed by God. And then we get a summarizing genealogy in the second half of the verse. The son of David, the son of Abraham, which kind of summarizes the whole genealogy in a very simple phrase. So this first verse gives us an introduction. And that then brings us to the structure of this genealogy, and this is fascinating. You may be aware that that Jewish tradition loves numbers. They often add up, you know, each letter of the Hebrew alphabet represents a number. So Aleph, the first letter, is 1, Beit is 2, Gimel is 3, and so on and so forth. And so you can add up the numbers of people's names. It's called gematria, if you want the formal term. There's a whole study in Judaism about gematria. But here's an interesting thing, because Matthew makes the point of telling readers that there are 14 generations from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah. You might be thinking, why would you do that? What's the point of that? Well, you may be aware that the number 7 in Hebrew thinking is indicative of something that's perfect or whole or complete. It's no surprise to me that creation is described as a 7-day event, with God resting on the 7th day, because 7th is complete and whole. Some commentators have suggested that the reason we have 14 here is, and this will sound very strange, does to most of us, I think, today, but this is something greater than perfection. This is not just perfect, this is really, really, really perfect. Now, we know there's no such thing. It's not logical, but this is hyperbole, it's exaggeration. And again, in Jewish tradition, they're not afraid to exaggerate something. But there's a couple of problems here, and you might even think that Matthew's kind of fiddling the books a bit here with his numbers, because if you actually trace the history, it's a bit problematic. In the second 14 generations, he's actually missed out 5 kings. So it really should be 19, not 14. And then in the third one, it's actually 13 generations, not 14. So there's a bit of oddness going on there. But let's remember, and I think this is important to say, that Matthew's not doing history, Matthew's doing theology. Matthew's telling a story. And again, this may even sound offensive to some of you, but the reality is that in Judaism, you don't let the facts get in the way of a good story because the story is more significant. So what's going on here? What is Matthew doing here? Well, one suggestion has been that the reason there's only 13 generations in that last block is because Matthew's message, part of Matthew's message, is that the church, and when he uses church, he's not talking about a building or a denomination, he's talking about the people of God, that the people of God are the 14th generation. The people of God are the completion of that eminently perfect plan and story that is unfolding, the story of God. Well, if that's correct, that puts us in a very interesting situation, doesn't it, as part of the church. We are the completion, the living completion. Or, if you like, maybe not completion, but we are the completing work. It's an ongoing work of what God began right back at Abraham, continues on through us. Well, I want to mention a few specifics in the genealogy which I think are interesting as well. By beginning with Abraham, it probably doesn't surprise us, but it emphasises the beginning of Israel's faith. And if you look, if you read the story of Abraham, and many of you will know this, Abraham came from a place called Ur of the Chaldees, which is in modern-day Iran. He was not a Jew. You know, it's interesting. Some people sort of in the popular realm think, oh, Abraham was a Jew. Well, no, he wasn't a Jew. He was actually from that Mesopotamian area. He was a Mesopotamian. So, interestingly, Abraham is a Gentile who becomes the father of the Jews. And so he is an interesting example for Matthew, because part of Matthew's gospel is that the gospel is not just for the Jews, but it's also for the Gentiles. It's for the non-Jews. Another interesting thing in the genealogies is the mention of women. Tamar may have been an Israelite, we don't know, but the other three clearly were not Israelites. There's Tamar, there's Rahab, there's Ruth, and there's Bathsheba. Well, I should say Bathsheba could well have been an Israelite as well. We don't have time to explore the stories of those women, but just a couple of comments I think are important. Tamar was one who was treated terribly by her father-in-law Judah, and you may know that Judah was central to the story that unfolded. But actually, if Tamar hadn't have been in the story of Judah, then Judah wouldn't have become who he became, and the story would have turned out quite differently. Many of you will know the story of Ruth. And it's interesting, in the book of Ruth, Ruth is almost always referred to as Ruth the Moabite. And again, if you think about that, the Moabites were the sworn enemies of the Israelites. In fact, in Deuteronomy and Nehemiah, it tells us that even after 10 generations, Moabites are not to be allowed into the community of the Israelites. After 10 generations, that's roughly over 200 years. You still don't let them in. And yet Ruth the Moabite, again, if you took her out of the story, because she ends up with Boaz, and Boaz leads to the Messiah. Bathsheba. Many of you will know the story of David and Bathsheba. Like I said, she probably was an Israelite, but she was married to a Hittite. So from a Jewish point of view, if you're married to a Hittite, it doesn't matter whether you're Jewish or not, you're not Jewish. These days we talk about it as being you married out. You married out of Judaism. But it's interesting that all of those women are praised in Jewish tradition. And if you look back at the stories of them in the Old Testament, you'll see that they contributed to critical ways for this story of Jesus, the Messiah, to unfold. If you read other ancient genealogies, you will very rarely, if ever, find a female name. They don't figure at all. And yet these women are prominent. This is a story of inclusion. The gospel is not just a story for those who are in and those who are out. It's a story which brings those who are out to the inner circle. And if you think about the ministry of Jesus, you can read it in the Gospel of Matthew and the other Gospels. It's very interesting because much of Jesus' time was spent with people on the outer. In fact, the people that he had most problems with were the people who were on the inside. He spent a lot of time with Gentiles. He spent a lot of time with people who were not in the religious establishment. In the second half of the genealogy, verses 7 to 11, there's a couple of things I'll point out. I'm only really just scratching the surface here this morning because of time. But there's a mention of Asa, King Asa. And some manuscripts actually have Asaph, and Asaph was actually a psalm writer. And so some have suggested that in verses 7 and 8, the mention of Asa or Asaph is actually saying that this story of Jesus is not just about what happened before in the history of Israel. It actually includes the Psalms, that the Psalms speak of Jesus. There's also in verse 10 a king called Amon, and some manuscripts have Amos, who we better know as a prophet. And again, the suggestion is that perhaps Matthew was alluding to the idea that the prophets were speaking of Jesus, and Jesus himself says that at times in his ministry. He talks about Moses and the prophets and how these things speak of him. So when they're understood in this way, it suggests that Jesus fills out the story of the Psalms and the prophets alongside the rest of the Hebrew Bible. You notice I'm using the term filled out rather than fulfilled, because I think that's a more accurate description of what's happening here. Jesus is filling out the story that's already begun. Jesus is not disconnected from his Jewish background, but he's bringing a new dimension. And then the final section of the genealogy in verses 12 to 17. Joseph's father here is Jacob, which is really interesting because if you read the genealogy in Luke chapter 3, you'll find that his father is Heli, totally different person. So what's going on there? Well, I think Joseph here is an echo of Joseph in the story of the Old Testament. If you remember back, the story of Joseph, and you can read that for yourself in Genesis 37 through to 50. But Joseph was an interpreter of dreams. He was a morally chaste person. He took a saving trip to save his family. He went to Egypt. And, well, he didn't go to Egypt through his desire, but he ended up saving his family by going to Egypt. And also, Joseph was a forgiver. He forgave his brothers, who really gave him up for dead. And so it seems that in the genealogy at the end here, perhaps Matthew is identifying Jesus, this one to come, with Joseph in the Old Testament. This is not interested in biology and genetics. This is interested in theology and how Jesus connects the story of the old with the new. So let me just finally make a few reflections thinking about how this story might speak to us today. The first one is that Jesus is the fulfillment of Israel's purposes and hopes, a part of God's continuing story. And we can think of ourselves in the place of Israel, that we are the ongoing fulfillment of what God has been doing in the world since the very beginning. So if you've ever wondered to yourself, what's the point? Why am I here? Why are we here? Is there any point in going on? Well, yes, there is, because we are part of what God has planned from the very beginning, for us as individuals, but also for us as a community. That 25 years of history that Lyndon talked about earlier in the service is a significant contribution to God's work in the world. And one of the interesting things there is that God's work in the world is not limited just to the church. I'm pretty thankful for that because, you know as well as I do that we don't always get it right. We don't always do it as well as we possibly could. But fortunately for us, we're blessed in that God's work transcends us as Christian people. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't include us. So we're very much a part of that. The second one, and I've mentioned this a couple of times already, and Linda mentioned this as well, the Messianic story is inclusive. Ancestry and inheritance in the ancient world was always traced through the father's line. But the mentioning of women, the inclusion of women in these genealogies is remarkable. I don't think we can fully comprehend that from a 21st century Western perspective. But if you were an ancient person hearing this text or reading this text and you came across female names in a genealogy, you would go, what? What are they doing there? You might even get angry and say they shouldn't be there. But they're there, and they're there for a very good reason. If you look at the way that Jesus related to women in the gospel stories, again, we might sort of say, well, that's reasonable. He's being respectful and he's considering women to be equal human beings to himself. Now, that's all true, but in the ancient world, the way that he relates to females is revolutionary. You might remember the story of Mary and Martha, and Mary sits at Jesus' feet and listens. And instead of doing what might be culturally expected, saying to Mary, get up and help your sister Martha get the food ready, he actually says to Martha, you know what, she's done a better thing. She's done a better thing, sitting at my feet and listening. So the inclusion of women is remarkable, and we need to take notice of that. Third thing, second last thing, Jesus is the Messiah, the anointed, the chosen one. He would lead people in inclusiveness in a way that had never been done for Israel before. If you look back at Israel's history, the way they would include people was by fighting them and taking them over and consuming them into the kingdom. That's the way the ancient world worked. If you were a Babylonian, you were inclusive as long as you come into my kingdom and follow my rules and behave like I tell you to behave. But in Jesus' story, it's not a compelling inclusion. It's an invitational inclusion. That's the kind of community that the church was to become. And Jesus was the leader of that, the example of that. And the last one, God is present, but God is sometimes what we might call a hidden actor. It's interesting in the genealogy that we have here that there's no explicit mention of what God is doing. On the surface, it's simply this one begat that one, and that one begat that one, and so on and so forth. But the implicit message of Matthew is that God is at work. God is at work in the world. God is at work through history. God is not absent from history. So I hope that encourages you this morning to recognize that this genealogy, written so many years ago, some 2,000 years ago, speaks to us today because it speaks to us of the way that God's story is continuing to unfold. And it speaks to us today of the way in which each one of us here and our communities are a part of that unfolding story. God still wants to continue to work through us if we're open and willing for that to happen. Let's pray together as we finish. Loving God, we thank you for the way that these words can speak to us if we're willing to listen. We thank you for the stories that have been preserved in the pages of Scripture, not just this story, but the many others as well, that all testify to the way that you are at work from the very beginning and you continue that work today. I pray that for this fellowship here at Mount Hawthorn Community Church, that there would be another 25 years and perhaps beyond, where you would continue to do the work that you've been doing in this place through this community. We thank you for your presence. We thank you for the work of your Spirit. We thank you for the hope that we have in Jesus, the Son of God, who lived, who died, who rose again, and who will return. We thank you for this in Christ's name. Amen. So I think we have
time for a couple of questions.
Yeah, just a couple of things, David. Thanks. In genealogy, it's the number is exponential, yes? So two parents, 4, 8, 16, going back. So 2 to the power of 42 would be countless millions of people that Jesus descended from, all sperm and egg descendants. The other thing is we have an understanding of biology that they didn't have, which was that women are not the vessels of the implanted man. Women we all have mitochondria in our cells. Every human cell contains mitochondria, and that DNA only comes from the woman. So Jesus is a product of man and woman going back through millions of men and women. I'm just interpreting what you've told us through a different lens, maybe. Yeah. But that thing of they are fully rooting Jesus in the story of the human race. That's interesting for me because as a kid, I had to contend with these sort of stories about some sort of mysterious insemination process happening from what? But it sounds like what they're telling us is that Jesus is the product of the human story and containing, as a human being, he contained DNA that had mitochondria, right? So otherwise he wasn't human.
Yeah, yeah.
Therefore, half woman.
And it's interesting, in the first few centuries of the church, the two issues that they grappled with was the humanity of Christ and the divinity of Christ. And not just that, but how does that work together?
And what is not divine about humanity?
Yeah, and it was very tempting for some to sort of say, oh, Jesus was human, but sort of a godly kind of human, or Jesus was some kind of divine godly ghost but not really human. And eventually they came to the realization that, well, actually somehow the mysterious nature of it, but that Jesus is both and those things, which is quite incredible.
I might have missed something, but I'm just a little bit confused. There are genealogies of Joseph and genealogies of the maternal line, but technically speaking, he doesn't have any DNA from Joseph, right? That's the theology, right?
Yeah.
So well, why are there genealogies of Joseph?
Well, the genealogy is actually from Abraham. So Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then Joseph is one of the sons of Jacob. So the line follows through there. But the thing is that ancient people didn't see it. They don't, as Ken just said, they didn't understand the medical or the biological, genetical side of things.
So Mary was a virgin. So Joseph,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. But yes, but from a legal point of view, Joseph is seen as the father of Jesus. That gives Jesus legitimacy from a legal perspective. It's not a biological perspective. Yeah. So you've actually got, so it's interesting that if you put the two genealogies together, the one in Matthew and the one in Luke, you've actually got the two lines, one coming to Joseph and one coming to Mary. Now, the Mary, clearly the Mary one was biological because she bore the child. But the Joseph one was not biological. But then, you know, if I can be provocative here, I mean, there's some interesting questions about Mary as a virgin as well. It's interesting that it comes from Isaiah, where the terminology used there, it's often translated as a virgin will conceive, but the word in Hebrew is just a young woman who would be presumed to be a virgin, but not necessarily. And then even in the Greek, the term that's used there has been translated as virgin, but it can equally well be translated as young woman as well. So there's quite a bit of complexity around that. Yeah, yeah. I don't know if that clarifies that, but interesting. Yeah.
We'll leave it there.